cual llega a su destino.
Graham Nash wrote that song. I once asked Graham to go sailing with me. He was expecting to go out for the afternoon, something like that. 5,000 miles in the canal later, we got to San Francisco. We started out in Fort Lauderdale.
My first sail.
But first time he'd ever gone. Brave dude. And that's where he saw his first whale.
That's right.
A real blue. Don't see him often. I've been sailing 55 years. I've only seen one. So, since I've stopped taking most of the other risks that I used to take, pretty much all of them, although I do occasionally let my kid drive, I've taken to taking other kinds of chances, which is what I'm about to nervously do right now. It's a brand new song. It's called A Slice of Time. Slice of time curling, peeling back from the edge of the night. Light fluttering as if between two trains, motor drive frame of life. Long blends of day stream into night. Consciousness barely coping. Going by, seem level, really the tracks are increasingly sloping. Images, 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 images arranged against the blank wall.
Images, images, images,
telling the truth to us all. Pluck out a day, a week or an hour. Hold it up to the light. The frame, really look at the faces with all of your sighs.
see the eye looking at you. Immerse yourself in to that minute. My teacher said time is elastic. I wonder just what I'll find in it. Images, 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 images arranged against the blank wall. Images, 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 telling the truth to us all. A slice of time curling, peeling back from the edge of the
que lo tendrán que pagar. No servirá el dinero para remediar tanto mal. Contra vuestra coacción surgirá la reacción. La sangrienta cuenta atrás se tendrá que parar. Y aunque siempre vigiles y mis datos controles. No es tan fácil hacerme callar. Resistiré, resistiré hasta el fin. Resistiré, resistiré hasta el fin.
California Radio Insomnia. Here's Attack 77 with Jody.
Spears broadsides. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. I'm Robert Norris, and we're going to be doing interviews this hour and the next with homeless activists and activists against poverty throughout the country. Starting with Orlando Food Not Bombs. On the line with me is, well, why don't you sign in there, Orlando?
My name
you
is
there?
Dan Markison.
Hang on a second. Can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah, I sure can.
Okay, make sure you've turned down your radio or your internet connection, because otherwise you're going to get echoed out there.
Yeah, I don't have any internet right now.
Okay, so who are we talking to?
My name is Ben Markison, and I'm a member of Orlando Food Not Bombs.
Okay, and Ben, you and I spoke actually a couple of days ago. Because you were arrested about, what, 9 days ago?
Right, I was arrested on June 1st.
And today's the 9th, so that was 8 days ago. Okay. And I guess for those who don't know, Orlando Food Now Bombs has been engaged in an ongoing struggle to be left alone feeding poor people in Orlando.
Right, exactly. That sums it up neatly.
Give us a little bit of the history, Ben, if you will.
Well, Orlando Food Not Bombs has been sharing food twice a week in downtown Orlando for more than 5 years now. And in 2006, the city of Orlando passed an ordinance that severely restricts food sharing in parks in the downtown area. Basically, they're limiting each group to 2 permits per park per year. So in other words, we could only get 2 permits for two food sharings on 2 days in 12 months at Lake Eola Park. And we believe that people need to be able to eat 365 days a year. And that's why we're resisting the city, because they're trying to stop us from sharing food with poor and hungry people in a public park in downtown Orlando.
Now, I know Orlando, well, many Food Now Bombs, of course, exist across the world and across the country, but not all of them are terribly political in the sense that they don't press the issue that I know the Food Now Bombs that I worked with in Santa Cruz and in San Francisco did about 20 years ago, which is food, not bombs. Not so much, gee, let's give a little more charity to those hungry folks, but more, let's expose the priorities of the country, expose the anti-homeless laws, embarrass the politicians into fundamental change, and kind of alert the citizenry as to what's going on. When did Orlando Food Now Bombs begin?
Well, we began sharing about 5 years ago, and you're right. As the name would seem to suggest, Food Not Bombs is not a charity. We're a political group, and what we engage in, we do that because we want to bring attention to issues of poverty and inequality and militarism and our misplaced social priorities. And if I may give an example of what we're talking about here in Orlando, is we have a homeless population that hovers around 10,000 people in Central Florida, and on any given night there are only 2,000 shelter beds for those individuals. Yet we have a city, the city of Orlando, that is spending over $1 billion on a new arena for our professional basketball team, plus a performing arts center, and also they're going to spend $175 million to renovate a football stadium. And we think that the city of Orlando has misplaced priorities. We think that if they can spend $1 billion on venues, then they can spend some money on social services, or at least not stand in the way of all volunteer grassroots groups like Food Not Bombs and other groups that simply want to share food with poor and hungry people to meet an unmet community need. And we're not the only group in Orlando that does this. There are probably about 24 groups that in some way come to downtown Orlando and share food with the population that's there that needs that food. Most of them are faith-based groups. We're one of the only political groups.
Now, we've talked with Keith McHenry, who is going to be on the air again at 6:30, if he calls in, which I hope he does.
I think he will. We talked earlier today.
That's good. And you're getting a lot of coverage and different media. Of course, you're on Democracy Now! Briefly on Tuesday for the arrests that happened on Monday. And there have been a total of, as I understand it, 12 arrests so far on...
Right. Five people were arrested yesterday, including 3 members of Orlando Food Not Bombs and 2 members of Tarpon Springs Food Not Bombs.
Tarpon Springs?
Yeah, Tarpon Springs is on the west coast, is a small community on the west coast of Florida, has about 22,000 people, and they have a brand new Food Not Bombs chapter that's only been sharing for 3 weeks. And in what you could call a spontaneous act of solidarity with us, 4 of their members came over yesterday, and two of them got arrested in the park for labeling out food to people. The police count the number of times that our volunteers ladle out food, and after they've ladled out to the 26th person, they move in and arrest them for violating the city's large group feedings ordinance.
Now, one of the things that isn't really being covered by the national media that we haven't covered in any detail are anti-homeless laws in Orlando and possibly in Tarpon Springs. What's the story for homeless people who need to sleep outside, who want to use public spaces, who try to solicit funds publicly, who need to go to the bathroom, strangely enough, all that sort of stuff?
Well, unfortunately, to begin with, the city of Orlando doesn't have any public restrooms downtown except for the public restrooms that are in public parks.
City of Orlando is how large?
The city of Orlando has a population of about 220,000 people, and the metropolitan area has a population of about 1.5 million.
Wow. No bathrooms. So what are people are supposed to bring their colostomy bags and their catheters? What's the deal?
I guess so, because it seems that the city of Orlando doesn't want poor and homeless people in its parks, because not only is it trying to stop us from sharing food with them, but a local lawyer is doing some research on this issue, and she found out that last year 221 people were trespassed from Lake Eola Park, and most of them were homeless people, and they were trespassed for some very trivial reasons. One was trespassed because apparently he did something to frighten the ducks.
Well, that could be a very serious matter, you know. I mean, Donald is a figure in probably at least a number of Disneylands, is well-beloved, and you wouldn't want to frighten Donald Duck.
Well, especially not in Orlando, because we are the home of Disney, after all.
Oh, yes, of course. I've never been to Orlando. So to be trespassed means to be told you're in violation of a trespass law, you face a charge, and you are no longer allowed to return to that park?
Right, for 1 year. And that's just one of the measures that the city of Orlando uses. Orlando is probably one of the only cities in the country that actually has what it calls begging zones, which are basically blue boxes that are defined by blue lines that are on sidewalks in downtown Orlando. And if you want to panhandle, you're only allowed to panhandle within those boxes. And the city passed an ordinance about a year or so ago that restricts panhandling to 7 a.m. To 7 a.m. to 7 p.m.
It sounds like they're following in Santa Cruz's footsteps. We've had an anti-panhandling law that bans all panhandling after dark, even with a sign silently. It creates a 14-foot forbidden zone around every building, bench, statue, crosswalk, kiosk, sidewalk cafe, fence in the downtown area. Actually, it's throughout the city. And, of course, there's also a sitting and a lying ban. Do you have your sitting bans in Orlando as well?
We have a sitting and lying ban, and we also have a camping ban.
And what's going on with the camping ordinance? I know here in California they run into trouble in Los Angeles and San Diego. Advocates for a no sleeping for the homeless law has run into trouble because under the Jones settlement in Los Angeles and the similar Spencer settlement in San Diego, they can't do that because, in essence, just like 20 years ago, the judge ruled in the Pottinger case in Miami that the things like sleeping, camping, even urinating and defecating are life-sustaining behaviors, and they can't be criminalized unless there are facilities that people can go to. And, of course, as you pointed out, and it's true as in Santa Cruz tonight, there is actually zero open spaces for people to go to. You have to be on a waiting list or on a program, perhaps with the exception of three potential beds in the River Street shelter if you're really, really lucky.
Yeah, and the problem with the facilities that do exist is a lot of the homeless people really don't want to use them because they're unsafe and they're unsanitary. And like the men's pavilion at our local Central Florida Coalition for the Homeless, which is like our civically sanctioned homeless charity that the mayor of Orlando, Buddy Dyer, likes. The pavilion for men is like one big open building where they just sleep on the floor. And I've heard from homeless people who have slept there that they've woken up the next morning to find that their shoes were taken from them.
Well, sounds like something out of the 30s or the 1890s.
Charles Dickens, for sure.
kind of hobo activity. So you've been involved with the Orlando Food Now Bombs for how long?
For about 5 years.
And during that period of time, the average membership of Orlando Food Not Bombs has been what?
It's fluctuated a little bit, but usually we have about 15 to 25 core members. These are the people who do the work to make the group function and to carry out our mission.
And In the last month, has there been a rise or fall in Orlando Food Not Bombs membership?
Well, our membership has actually increased, and we've actually gotten an amazing outpouring of support from within the city of Orlando and from people in Central Florida, around the state, the country, and even the world. Because, I mean, almost everyone I've talked to and heard from thinks it's absolutely ridiculous to arrest people for trying to help people and trying to share food with them to fight poverty.
If these 12 people arrested, and you were among them, and so was Keith McHenry, co-founder of Food Not Bombs,
right.
How many of you have been arrested before?
I've been arrested before. I was arrested on resisting arrest without violence in December, and what happened was I was at our food sharing, and they had sent the Orlando police out to write parking tickets to our volunteers who pulled into this cul-de-sac next to the picnic area at Lake Eola Park, and they were writing tickets to them to harass them, and I walked up to this police officer simply to say something to him, and he didn't appreciate it, and within about 20 seconds, I was in handcuffs.
Were you, how long were you held in jail?
Oh, I would say I was in jail for about 8 hours before my bond was processed.
And indeed, there, you don't get OR'd in Orlando very easily. Here in Santa Cruz, most, even when I was arrested, and I was arrested several times for serving free food 22 years ago, they bail you. You don't get bailed out. You get OR'd out. They don't want to keep you. What do you got, special privatized jails that enjoy having you there, or what's the deal?
Well, I could have gotten RORed, and I would have been willing to, but as soon as people saw me being arrested, they started making phone calls, and within minutes, a good friend of mine was on his way down to a bail bondsman to start the process of getting me bonded out. So before the police were even done typing up their charging affidavits, which I swear took this cop like 2 hours, you know, it was only like two paragraphs long. They already had the paperwork started, so I wasn't even eligible to be ROR'd because someone had already started bonding me out.
How much was the bond?
The bond was $250.
Bail was $2,500?
No, bail, in this case, we only had to pay $100 to the bondsman, but the bond is $250 if you pay it directly, but we went through the bondsman, and we paid $100.
Which you never got back.
No, because the way it works is you can pay the $250 directly to the county, or in our case, we went through the bondsman. We gave him $100, and he paid the $250, and then I signed an indemnity agreement that if I didn't show up to court, I would pay the $250. But what happened was they dropped the charges, which is usually what happens when you get that sort of charge.
And so, what, you weren't able to get your $100 back?
No, I did get my $100 back.
So it did come back. I think in Santa Cruz, unless you pay the entire bail yourself, if you go through a bondsman, you essentially lose 10% of the bail.
No, not in this case.
No, that's good. So they drop charges. So you're just not a convicted felon. You don't sound so interesting, Ben. You know, I'm sorry. But now you have another case coming up. You're convicted of violating the famous, what, 26 people only twice a year permit proposal or law that they have?
Yeah, I was arrested for allegedly violating the city of Orlando's large group feedings ordinance. And I have a lawyer who will be representing me. And under his advice, I can talk about anything except the details of my own case and the courtroom details. But I can talk about anything else.
Well, I wouldn't want you to disclose, for example, the exact nature of the food you were giving away.
Well, I can pretty much tell you the type of food that we share because we share the same type of food week in and week out. And on Mondays for breakfast, we have vegan pancakes, grits, oatmeal, and fried potatoes, along with bread and fruit and coffee. And then usually for dinner, we'll have a stew or vegetable soup. And then we'll have other vegetables along with bread and pastries and coffee. And we always have rice. We have what we call Catalina's Spanish rice, which is named after the grandmother of one of our members. She lets us cook at her house, and she has the Spanish rice recipe that we make every week because it's so good.
Now, do you also get food that is still good but is being discarded by grocery stores, and do you use that?
Sure, we get donations from various sources.
Has there been any pressure on stores, as, for example, has happened in Santa Cruz, not to donate to you?
So far, there haven't been any problems in that regard.
Now, what about tent cities? As I understand that there was a tent city, I was either in Orlando or it was in Miami, or St. Petersburg.
It was in Miami. It was organized by a community organizing group called Take Back the Land that works in the inner city, Liberty City, in Miami.
Uh huh. Tell me about that.
Well, basically, they have the same problems in Miami that we have in Orlando and that we have all over the country, basically, which is that poor people and working class people have really been squeezed over the last few decades, and there's a lack of affordable housing. And because there was this lack of affordable housing in Miami, they basically found a vacant lot in inner city, which is in Liberty City, which is like the inner city in Miami. It's a very poor African-American neighborhood, and they found this vacant lot, and they basically started erecting, like, shanties and tents to house people.
Did they ask for permission and permits, or did they just start doing
it? No, not at all.
And
they took direct action.
When did they do that, and has it still survived?
No, it lasted a few months, and what happened was, after a while, the city of Miami opened negotiations with them because they were embarrassed, basically. Because I think that, see, cities really don't want poor and working people and homeless people in their downtowns. But whenever they take these draconian measures like arresting people who want to share food or trying to stop people from camping on vacant lots or going into vacant homes and living there because they don't have any place else to live, and they go in and they arrest people, then the cities usually become embarrassed because they know that the majority of people feel a sense of what you could call social solidarity with poor people. But at the same time, most city governments, it seems, are more interested in doing what the gentrifiers and the developers and the business interests want, and they want to be able to do that. But what happens is often the public outcry when people realize what's happening becomes too much, and then they retreat under the glare of the media spotlight and just under the glare of public outrage that people could get arrested for doing something that's necessary in order to simply survive as a human being in an economy that still has, you know, 10% unemployment, 1/6 of the population on food stamps, not enough good jobs, too many low-wage service jobs, cutbacks in social services, a lack of affordable housing.
Have you gotten much support from, and are there many Spanish-speaking volunteers?
We have a few Spanish-speaking volunteers. We are still in the process of building our community support and solidarity with various groups. This has become like a campaign, and it has a political dimension as well. And over the coming months, we'll be unveiling what you could call our political strategy, because this issue of food sharing has to be looked at in a context. And the context is that it's just part of the broader problem of poor and working people being squeezed because we have a government that's dominated by people who don't care about helping poor and working people and only want to help corporations and business interests. Because we've seen what's happened with Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin. We've seen what's happened with our own governor here in Florida, Rick Scott, who decided to balance Florida's budget on the backs of poor and working people.
So have other cities in Florida adopted similar laws, and is there a similar process happening throughout the state, and is there resistance in those cities if that's the case?
Well, at one point, the city of Fort Lauderdale was proposing to adopt an ordinance similar to Orlando's after we had lost at the federal appeals court level. But because of the resistance that's been put up by Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs, because of the resistance that they've seen in Orlando, and because of the public outcry, they retreated from that for right now. But there has been resistance in other cities in Florida because over the years, St. Petersburg, Tampa, Fort Myers, Gainesville, and other cities have all tried to clamp down on groups like Food Not Bombs and others that simply try to provide services to poor and working people, whether it's food, clothes, medical care, whatever.
And have you been in contact with those groups? Is there a sort of a, I imagine with all the media and the call has gone out across Florida to help. I know one person, I sent out an email yesterday mentioning this show and mentioning the 12 arrests and the fact that you or someone of your other folks would be speaking, and immediately got an email from a guy in Florida that he was heading for Orlando to help.
Great. Yeah, so, he's welcome. We want as many people as possible to come out and stand in solidarity with us, because the more support that the administration or Mayor Buddy Dyer sees that we have, the more likely they are to back down from this, because they would love to get rid of us and they'd love to get rid of poor and working people in downtown Orlando, but I think they're beginning to realize they can't do that because the public is with us, not them. Because most people in the public, even if they're not poor, they understand what it is like to be poor, and they understand how vulnerable they are to being in the same conditions as some of the people we share with. They understand that they're only a few paychecks away from being poor, from being homeless themselves.
Now, you mentioned when we talked earlier that you've had 17 arrests in the last 5 years.
Right.
Have any of those folks been convicted of anything?
No, the first arrest under the ordinance was in 2007. That was our friend Eric Montanez, and he was acquitted at a jury trial. And then a few months after his arrest, six of our members were arrested for allegedly violating a noise ordinance during a demonstration against Mayor Buddy Dyer at a campaign fundraiser he was having, and they were acquitted at a jury trial.
And what about the others and the 17?
Well, it's a total, actually, of 19 people. And the 12 most recent arrests, our first court date is June 30th. That's for the first three people who were arrested, which is me, Keith, and Jessica Cross.
Have you had volunteer attorneys stepping forward, or are you defending yourselves in pro per? Are there public defenders who are defending you? What's going on with that?
We have a local attorney who has stepped forward to defend those who have been arrested and those who will get arrested. He's doing it pro bono because he believes in the cause.
And, of course, you are considering appealing the en banc decision of the panel of the federal court all the way up to the, God help us, Supreme Court?
Right. We're still in consultation with our legal counsel on what our options are on that, because there's financial issues involved in that. Food Not Bombs is a group venture. We've gotten some donations recently, but until a few weeks ago, we had about $80 in our treasury.
And it costs thousands of dollars to go to the Supreme Court, of course.
Right. The filing the appeal itself is cheap, but then you have to provide them with dozens of copies of transcripts and filings, and those have to be printed and bound in a certain format. And our lawyer estimated it would cost about $5,000 just to supply the Supreme Court with that paperwork.
Not exactly a poor man's justice system.
No, not at all. You know what they say about capital punishment? Those without the capital get all the punishment.
That
certainly applies here. One thing I wanted to mention, if I may, is that on the first day of each month, we're asking all the Food Not Bombs groups and any other groups that are in solidarity with us to hold demonstrations at their respective city halls in Florida or around the country, because all the problems that groups like Food Not Bombs or other groups that want to share food with poor and working people have always emanate from city officials, because there's just something about people handing out food for free in public spaces that just really freaks out local city officials.
Yeah, so there's never been an initiative that attempted to ban Food Not Bombs. It's always been executive actions or legislative actions by city officials and their political cronies, right?
Right, exactly.
We're talking with Ben Matheson, is that correct?
Markeson, M-E-R-K-E-S-O-N.
Thank you, Ben Markeson. I appreciate that. And I actually do have your name here properly spelled, but can't read my own typing.
That's okay.
It's coming up on 6:30 my time, 9:30 your time. I'm going to get, hopefully, Keith should be calling in shortly, so I'm going to say goodbye to you. Anything you want to conclude with, and is there a website where people can go to get more information about and to give help to Orlando Food Not Bombs?
Yes, there is. Our website is orlandofoodnotbombs.org, and Keith has a national Food Not Bombs website, which is foodnotbombs.net. And both of those are excellent sources of information. I recommend Keith's website for a national overview of what's going on with Food Not Bombs groups around the country, because unfortunately we're just one of several Food Not Bombs groups around the country that are facing problems right now.
Hey, Ben, thank you. And I'm eager to know whether you're actually going to get down to City Hall to start serving food there. Keith kind of gave a suggestion that if you guys decide to do it, you may be doing it a week from tomorrow, going down to City Hall. And also,
there is an initiative to expand our weekly sharing to 3 times a week and to do a sharing regularly at Orlando City Hall, because Mayor Buddy Dyer was quoted as saying, well, he doesn't want us at Lake Eola Park. He doesn't mind if we come to Orlando City Hall and share every day of the week. So we're going to take him up on it and see if he's true to his word.
Well, give him a ladle and some lettuce and see if he gets down and starts helping out.
I sure will.
Hey,
thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Ben Markson. Appreciate you being on.
Take care.
Bye-bye. And that was Ben Markson of Orlando Food Not Bombs calling in. You are tuned to Free Radio 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org if you're listening on the Internet. My name is Robert Norris, and the name of this show is Bath Robespierre's Broadsides, from the famous French revolutionary guy Robespierre, and from the bathrobe that I run around with on occasion when there are sleeping band demonstrations in Santa Cruz to dramatize the fact that it's illegal to sleep outside if you're homeless, but there's no legal place to go in spite of that ban, putting people in a impossible situation, and, of course, reflecting what's happening around the country. We're going to hopefully hear shortly from Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs. I'm going to take a musical interlude here, and depending on which number he calls in on, I will give out the second number for other folks to call in on with questions, and that could be our man right now. We'll see if he's actually here. Let's see how that goes. Hey there, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Yeah, this is Keith with Food Not Bombs in Orlando, Florida.
Hey, Keith, did you hear Ben Markson speaking?
No, I did not hear him speak. I'm sorry. I was being interviewed by a reporter in Miami about a very funny situation that's occurred.
Tell me about that.
Okay, what happened was I just received an email from a group of people who are claiming they're going to shut down the, put up a note or something on the City of Orlando website to protest what's happening. These are like the cyber protesters.
Oh, yeah, we had something like that happening in Santa Cruz back in December in protest of Peace Camp 2010's, the arrests here of the homeless folks with that particular protest.
Yeah, that was interesting. This was like something called cyber rights, people.
Huh.
So that just came in, and I put it out to a few journalists to see if they knew anything about it, if that was of interest, and so a person did call.
Cyber
so
terrorists. Actually, the FBI did come to Santa Cruz seeking for the cyber terrorists, so-called. Apparently, the county's website was shut down for half an hour here in Santa Cruz in protest of the prosecution, arrest, and general harassment of not just homeless people and also specifically the Peace Camp 2010 protesters who are still facing, they're appealing, but one of them is facing a second trial. The rest of them are looking for a trial, and Linda LeMaster is coming up for a trial in July.
Wow.
You, on the other hand, you're facing a trial in who knows when, 6 months down the road? You were telling me before that in old Orlando, you don't get no speedy trial, or if you do, it's... What were you telling me about the situation in Florida?
Okay, well, basically, I would go to my arraignment on the 5th of July, and it is actually, once you're out of jail and everything, it's a fairly fast. If I was waiting trial, I could have stayed... if I was in jail waiting trial, I could have stayed the whole 6 months. until it was resolved. But it would have to be resolved within 6 months. It can take that long.
It's interesting because in California, you have a right to be tried in 30 days if you're in custody and within 45 days if you're not for a misdemeanor charge.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, they don't have that here. So there's a lot of sick things about Florida laws, that's for sure. In fact, you have to actually go through all these hoops just to avoid paying fees for the public defender and stuff like that. And they take $5 from you automatically when you leave jail, from the jailers.
That's
to cover the expense of taking your picture.
Hell yeah.
So, that's crazy.
You've got to fund
it. It's a weird number of laws anyway, that's for sure.
So, what's been happening in the last few days after the, you mentioned to me when I talked to you, I guess it was yesterday, I guess it was today. Five were arrested yesterday, and the mayor has accused them, Mayor Buddy Dyer has accused them of being food terrorists.
Yeah, he was on Channel 9 TV, being quoted as saying that we were food terrorists. And we don't know exactly what that means. He seemed very frustrated that we weren't giving up and that this has ended up happening. And the support for Food Not Bombs is huge. You know, it's just unbelievable. People from all over the world are making videos about it and doing protests and are in support of us. And there was one in Milan outside the U.S. consulate that was organized there. There's another one in Detroit where they handed out 150 sandwiches and gave people other food. And so this is like kind of a Japanese group put up a petition. We definitely need people to sign it. Petition.
Which they can find on your website of what, foodnotbombs.net?
Yeah, it's on foodnotbombs.net. There, it's on the front page of the petition. It's a Japanese homeless rights group that put that up. And we've been getting lots and lots of emails on that. We're trying to get up to 1,000 tonight of signatures, and there's very few from all over the world are writing statements on this. And then we have a day without food, which is a protest that we're organizing on the 29th at the meal that we normally have, and we have like other techniques of getting food to the people. So ultimately, they won't go hungry, but we just want to show what it's like when a lot of people show up and there's no food.
Are you planning?
We're asking for people to fast on that day.
Are you, Keith?
And we also have letters that we're doing.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish what you're saying.
Then we have letter writing campaign too. We're trying to encourage Amnesty International. You were mentioned in a number of letters by Amnesty International when they considered declaring all Food Not Bombs activists prisoners of conscience if convicted, and you were so far the only one that was actually listed technically as a prisoner of conscience, since you were the only one convicted under those waves of
I think Geronimo Pratt suffered a lot more under that than I did, that's for damn sure. I was there for a month?
You were there for a month, yeah.
And Pratt,
but it's
been
still
there
something
years,
that,
27 years,
amazing and... that you know, Amnesty recognized the arrests of Food Not Bombs.
And we're talking about the San Francisco trials and arrests back in started in 88, but I was arrested in 93 and I served my time in 96. Since that time, how many arrests would you estimate Food Not Bombs has suffered throughout the the chapters throughout the world since 1996?
Oh, wow. It's kind of funny. I never really counted them, but, you know, there was like two people arrested in Brixton, and nothing came of their trial. That's in a neighborhood in London. They just had the charges dropped. Then there was 14 people arrested in Utrecht, Holland, but they also received a formal apology, and it was said to have been a mistake. Then there was four or five arrests in Tampa, and then eventually that law got changed to allow everybody to share food. There was a couple of arrests, maybe three or four arrests in Middletown, Connecticut. That state actually passed the law afterwards in response of saying that anyone can share food without restriction, without permit in the state. There were several arrests in the same time as the original arrest happened here of Eric. Back in 2007, there was also a wave of arrests in, Las Vegas, Nevada. And then there's also been arrests in Elgin, Illinois, threats of arrest, but no arrest so far in Northampton. There's been randomly all across the country, I would say periodically there will be a threats of arrest in these little kind of waves. And that's been going on. Most cities stop arresting, or don't even arrest. And a lot of cities are encouraged to call San Francisco to find out how well that went. And on doing so, usually they stop. So this is a little unusual, that this operation is continuing. And it's, also interesting that it's going to, other cities have announced that they're going to use the Orlando law against Funan bombs and create their own laws in Fort Lauderdale, St. Petersburg, Florida. There's another angle on it in Gainesville, Florida, called the meal limit, things like that. So there's like a lot of activity in Florida to try to limit access to food. So.
Of course, Funan bomb's main objective is not to get arrested, get publicity, and so forth. In terms of that, they though that's when Funan bomb's does get a lot of publicity. Funan bomb's has done other things. Like I know in San Francisco in 1989 and 1990, you were serving food probably at a faster rate than almost any Funan bomb's has ever done for Camp Agnos, as the Examiner called the tent city. Right outside Mayor Agnos's offices in the Civic Center Plaza.
Yeah, that we did the 24-hour-a-day vegetarian soup kitchen, and that worked very well. And it kept morale up. You know, we always needed people to watch the camp at night to make sure the police, you know, we were warned if cops raided or anything. And it was a very beautiful experience, and we actually have promoted the you know, I at one point I made a website called, it's on consensus.net, tentcity.html, and the idea was to promote the use of this tactic because it was so successful at a number of different things. I mean, in the end, we really only got a shelter that turned out to be really crazy, and it's now this multimedia, multi-purpose center or something, service center, which is on Polk Street in San Francisco. That was what that 27-day tent city achieved. It's not the greatest solution. I certainly wouldn't want to go there. It seems pretty crazy. But it's at least it's, you know, something. But the more important thing is that we made relationships in the tent city protest, and we got to know each other, and it was very empowering. And it did show that people uniting could do something, and that strategy was seems to really push the buttons of authoritarian regimes and just regular old city mayors like our Agnos, because you can see that that same technique is now being used all over the world, in, you know, like from Egypt to people did tent city protests all over Spain,
Tunisia, Bahrain, Yemen.
Yeah, everywhere. So this technique, I mean, I think it's 39 countries right now are doing this. It's intense. And then, so hopefully, you know, in fact, I got an email from a guy named David Swanson. He's the one that wrote most people know him for After Downing Street Memo, the website that he's maintained for quite some time. And he, in his email, it included all these organizations that are going to start camping out in front of the White House in Washington, D.C. on October 6th. And this is the U.S.-wide version of what happened in Egypt and so on. That's what they're hoping. And it's very interesting because I've been writing, David endorsed several other earlier attempts at tent city protests at the White House that I was helping promote. So, you know, this strategy is pretty interesting. So there's another call that's going on with the Funan bombs we had the Florida Funeral Bombs Gathering, and we urged all chapters to camp out overnight at their local city hall on the first of each month.
So it's not
and
just
we're trying to
serve...
get this to be a nationwide campaign.
It's, so it's,
and,
not just, it's not just to serve free food on the first of every month. It is to camp out overnight and then serve food as well.
Yeah, to serve food through the night, and or at least bring dinner and then stay overnight and have like pizzas and stuff, and then in the morning have breakfast, and then maybe do even a lunch. You know, if you've got the energy to do a lunch, a dinner, and then the breakfast the next morning, and the lunch at noon at the end. So that we were trying to get this idea started, and on July 1st, and it's a 3-day weekend. We're hoping this one will light the fire that gets everybody doing this. And you can see there's a Walkerville now in Madison, Wisconsin, that Food Not Bombs is providing food at. And so this kind of thing is starting, to be adopted as a idea. And we're really hoping people do this on the first of each month. And that's a limited amount of time. It's not like a big commitment, but maybe in doing it just one night, people will see the power, and then over time, this will develop where people are camping out in front of their city halls all over America, or everybody has gravitated towards something like D.C. or something like that.
What's the reaction, and you're perhaps not necessarily the person to talk to, since you're not an Orlando native, and you haven't been spending a lot of time in Orlando, but you have been there for a couple of weeks, right?
Yeah, I've been here since the 17th of May, but I certainly am being educated on the history of politics from all different levels. You know, I've been meeting with churches, labor, Democratic Party people to anarchists and libertarians. So, there's a wide spectrum of people here, and you do hear, like, narratives. What was the question?
I'm wondering what homeless people think of all the hubbub. I mean, in Santa Cruz, I think homeless people were generally glad that Food Not Bombs did what it was doing. It was primarily Food Not Bombs. You came down from San Francisco in 1988, 23 years ago, to support people like Jane Immler, Linda Edwards, Linda LeMaster, and others who were doing protests at the Santa Cruz City Council to try to end the sleeping ban ordinance, which we're still trying to end. And in the consequence, I guess, No Guns Radici and her son were arrested. Jane Immler was arrested. And a whole round of food felony stuff started happening. It wasn't felonies in the technical sense, but it was, I'm using that term whimsically, but there were mass arrests and cops showed up in riot gear. Of course, they'd already done that some months before in San Francisco when you were feeding in Golden Gate Park.
Yeah.
I guess, how did homeless people respond to you in Orlando? Are they pleased this is happening? Are they worried that there is a greater focus and crackdown on them? Is there actually more, are they being left alone more because there's, the spotlight of publicity on this absurd use of public resources to go after food servers? Are homeless people involved in the Orlando Food Not Bomb situation, or is it mainly middle-class students and things like that?
Well, it's pretty amazing. It's actually, so the first way, on the 18th of May, we did, we do it twice a week, the breakfast on Monday and the dinner on Wednesday. And almost everybody was a homeless person. I think there was four homeless people and two non-homeless servers risking arrest. And then that was the case day after day. And then, including when we shared food on June 1st, when people were sharing food, there was a number of people living on the streets of Orlando that were sharing the food. And we've been getting, like, anywhere we go, even before the arrest, people on the streets were really supportive. I mean, we'd go all over town to different, programs and stuff like that. And then when I was in custody, there were many people that came up and to hug me and say that we fed them all the time, and they were really proud. And so our sense is they haven't used the strategy like they had in San Francisco to go talk to the homeless and try to make a division between the homeless and Food Not Bombs. The mayor has made almost quote for quote you can overlap what this mayor, Buddy Dyers, is saying to what Eric Dagnos was saying, and Frank Jordan even, you know, that...
San Francisco mayors.
The only more creative thing about Buddy Dyer is to say that we're food terrorists today, or yesterday. But the, all the regular things, you know, that we don't care about the homeless, we're just using them for our political agenda. Art Agnes was quoted saying that, and so was Frank Jordan. And, they could always serve under the bridge, you know, if they really cared.
Well, I know one of your concerns.
It's a very interesting series of patterns that are exactly the same, and the same rhetoric and logic as was used in Golden Gate Park.
Well, I know that when you first started serving, you actually began after Mother Teresa, who was serving in San Francisco, moved her operation out of the Civic Center and down to the kind of a more distant locale that was harder to access.
Yeah, there was at one point, I mean, we were already having, there was a lot of political tension at that time, and we'd already had three waves of arrests by that time, two waves. We had the 88 arrests in Golden Gate Park, and then there were roughly 300 arrests in Civic Center Plaza after the Tent City protest. And then Mother Teresa started, her Sisters of Charity started doing at some point in there, meals at Civic Center Plaza in front of City Hall, around 6 o'clock at night, something like that. And it was a huge number of people came to eat there. And I remember sometimes on Wednesdays at UM Plaza, when we served there, we would bring our leftovers over to them and help them out. Mother Teresa actually came to San Francisco, met with, this time Frank Jordan, and had a press conference agreeing to move to this place called the Firehouse. And the Firehouse is where the fire department had its Toys for Tots program. And they ended up, there was a controversy between Mother Teresa and the firefighters over the use of the space. And it was compromised that the Sisters of Charity would serve, but only have the lease for a certain number of hours per day at that space, something like 4 hours. And the thing was that they were sharing roughly 500 meals at the end of the month. Maybe 250 at the beginning of the month at that meal. And we continued to feed those numbers every night at the in front of City Hall. And her location was so hard to get to that it was there, her numbers were in the areas of about 20 to 30 people. And it's still that way now. It's still roughly about 20 to 30 people at this location out at on the wharfs, you know, between Hunters Point and the ballpark.
And that's still happening.
Nobody can go there.
It's still happening in San Francisco 20 years later.
Yeah. That little program, apparently, I went over there, and it's got the two little porta-potties and the Sister of Charity. Just out there with nobody coming because there's just no way to get there.
Well, operate mission successful, right? There you go. Frank Jordan, triumphs. He was the mayor, previously the police chief in San Francisco. In prior shows, you've talked about how Food Not Bombs has, in some cases throughout the country, been neutralized, depoliticized through a variety of things like name changes, infiltration, just sort of different strategies adopted by different Food Not Bombs that weren't at least what your vision was for the original Food Not Bombs. Is that changing at all? Is that still proceeding apace? What's going on with that?
Well, that's interesting. There is actually a lot of pushback. I published a flyer about this, and I have handed out hundreds and hundreds of copies of it, speaking at different colleges and speaking at two different groups and visiting groups. And it's starting to, and this is only in the United States, this issue. The rest of the world always brings literature and banners and tries to get a high visibility location and tries to make it fun. And tries to make it an event rather than a meal. And that's been only in the United States where that trend started taking off in around 1997. The basic thing that happened is that there becomes, somebody meets a Food Not Bombs organizer somehow in the community and suggests the name be changed so that it, because it, Tuna Bombs, that's too radical a name, and you'd get more food if you were called, you know, Feed Boulder. And then, and that's what they were doing, and they did this in a bunch of cities. And usually the chapters die shortly after they change their name and to something that's got no connection to trying to change society. And so then that's been one thing. The other is to volunteer to bring the literature and the banner and discard it on the way. That's been a common practice. But now we're urging people to realize that that's a possibility and to get make sure that whoever's bringing the literature and the banners, you know, is responsible and will remember and all that. So that's important. You know, other types of disruption. It seems like so far we haven't had a really bad, and the most big problems were people being the infiltration of the RNC 8, the three Funa Bombs houses in Minneapolis before the Republican National Convention, and Eric McDavid and his.
Let me interrupt you, Keith, because we talked about that before. Getting back to your arrest on a week ago Wednesday, you were first told you couldn't go back to Lake Eola Park, but then apparently, according to Ben, you guys found a loophole in that.
Yeah, one of the students that got arrested from Valencia College, community college here, he happened to be reading mostly the trespass form. And it turns out that you can call up the parks department and they have to let you go into the park if you're going to a First Amendment activity. So they can't trespass you for that. So we have started to do that, and we actually published flyers that we're handing out to all the people, that we see who, because there are several hundred people that are not allowed to go into Lake Eola Park because they've been trespassed. Well, now that we know this, they can all call to say that they want to come to the protest, which we're obviously having, and therefore they could get a free meal. So we're actually started a campaign doing that just this morning. So that is very positive.
And so you were at the Wednesday feedings in the park, and you weren't arrested?
Correct. I called up and I talked to the park dude and told him I was going to the protest. And he said, "Oh well, you can't do anything with you can't do anything with Food Not Bombs." And I'm like, "Well, I'm just doing a literature table with Food Not Bombs." You know.
And his response?
And nothing happened. I didn't get busted. That was positive.
But he did tell you not to do a literature table, and you defiantly went and did a literature table. Where's your sense of obedience, Keith?
I know, it's not too good. So it's been, we had, the other thing was amazing, you know, the part, people can go to foodnotbombs.net, and there's all this video and stuff we put all over it and everything, and the thing is that you can, Buddy Dyer, the mayor, he gets asked, the commentator goes, and the people that live around the lake, they just don't like it, and then they go to Buddy Dyer, and he talks. But what happened to us was all the people that, we had all these people that lived in the buildings coming to us yesterday during the meal and saying that, asking if we had a petition to sign and all this stuff, because they're like, we're really upset, you know, these people, you know, are, the mayor is saying they're arresting people for feeding people because of the people living in the buildings, but the people in the buildings don't mind us being there. So, quite interesting.
So you are getting community support.
Oh, a lot, yeah. I mean, just people came out of the condominiums to hang out with us. People, you know, just, it was amazing.
Are these mostly poor and working people? Are they yuppies? Are they mixture?
Well, the people that came out of these condominiums are relatively well off. Yeah, they're professional people. I mean, these are probably, I would say, maybe between $1,500 and $2,000 a month rent, and they're pretty fancy. There might be, or mortgages, you know, of that amount. So you have to have some money to be living around there. And they were coming down, they had coats and ties and business suits on, and were hanging out with us.
Although,
pretty amazing.
Your food servers are still largely homeless folks?
Basically, it's the same, it's a core group of the people that are living on the streets in Orlando, and the Funa Bombs people make up the college. It's an interesting mix. It's college students and people that live on the streets, and a bunch of workers that are like were college students like 2 or 3 years ago, and they're now young, you know, people working at bike shops and stuff like that. So there's a whole, so that's the, it's about 15, 20 core members, and that's what the makeup of it is.
How many homeless?
Very Christian homeless people that wear like, you know, elaborate Jesus hats and stuff like that to, that work with us.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty amazing.
How many homeless people have been arrested that you know of in this protest?
Well, that is fascinating. Even though these people are living on the street and they're hanging out, they're serving the food, none of them so far have been arrested. And not all the people that have been arrested have actually been people sharing food. So there's some other thing going on with the surveillance where they're figuring out who to arrest. But, no, you know, all the other people, TJ and all the other people that are, Sean and everybody that are out there from the streets sharing food, so far none of them have been busted, which is, I don't know what the point, you know, they do as much serving as anybody else. So.
Any sense of whether the laws against homeless people for sleeping, camping, living in a vehicle are any worse or any better than elsewhere, what their situation is?
Well, the Florida has probably the worst situation for homeless, one of the worst situations for homeless anywhere in the country. So, for instance, there's a lot of places that you cannot eat if you do not have a valid Florida ID. And so there's a huge effort to create, so there's an entire program here called iDignity, and it's all about getting your Florida driver's license so that you can eat at soup kitchens. And of course shelters are completely, you have to have a valid Florida ID. You can't have a Ohio ID or something like that. And so then the other thing is that there are shelters which are actually the same companies that built the county jail will then build next to the county jail another facility that's just like the county jail, but it's the shelter. And it's got concertina wire, razor wire, chain link fences. And the only difference is that you have to leave, like, you know, after coffee and donuts, if that's what they give you. They might give you that. It's not always guaranteed. And then you go to get back in, you got to come back later, you know, in the evening and get back in. And it's got guards and trustees from the county jails that run these places. So those are often shelters. That's in St. Petersburg, that kind of shelter. And you see that they're proposing that in other cities. And I've heard that that is in, like, other cities in Florida. So, yeah, you obviously, there are all kinds of crazy rules and regulations. I've never seen a place, like, anybody with an open container is automatically, like, you know, taken in if you don't look appropriate in this town. And they're very fast to do that. You know, little tiny things like that all the time. One man what I was in jail with was, it was downpour, it was huge, the amount of, it was like a flood. And so he went into a parking garage, and it turned out a guard in there saw him in there, and he was near where people pay the money to leave. And apparently that's illegal, and so he got jailed for that.
Oh, it's illegal in Santa Cruz, you know.
Yeah, so these laws are, and they have like 20 parking meters that you can put money in, and that money goes to the Salvation Army and stuff to help feed the poor. And
I mean,
panhandling boxes too.
We have those on the. They've been passed by the city council, but not yet put up. Perhaps they're afraid they will be appropriated as souvenirs of a repressive era by people who are sufficiently motivated. We're talking with Keith McHenry, Food Not Bombs, co-founder, author, jailbird, and I guess Tabler, in spite of the official advice from the Parks and Rec Department of Orlando not to go back to Lake Eola if he's going to be with Food Not Bombs tabling, and you did it anyway.
Yeah, I just did that anyway. I mean, at least I told him I was going to do it, so he seemed to think that was okay if I tell him. But he did, and so nothing happened. It was fantastic. There's also, like, some people that are kind of in fancier dark cars with sunglasses that people are claiming are the FBI that are driving around our meals and stuff like that. So we don't, it looks like there might even be more stuff happening than we even know. And there's been some really, there was a Detroit Underground did a, the meal sharing in Detroit, and they've done a lot of great stuff with us. That's, like, really cool. And there's a YouTube video that we have up. People are doing a lot. It would be great if Santa Cruz did some actions in solidarity. We have the one that we're calling on is the first of the month. We go to City Hall, camp out. You've got a great City Hall for camping out at.
It's illegal to be at City Hall after dark now. It's
crazy.
That's a new Rotkin regulation that got put in last year to stop Peace Camp 2010 from its protest. But, hey, that doesn't mean that we might not show up in order to spread a little light after dark, you know.
That would be really cool. Well, if there was actually ended up being a small number of arrests in solidarity with Orlando Food Not Bombs, if you were making it out that way, even though, I mean, you got your own issues, that you have problems there, too. So you definitely, you know, don't ignore those. But it, just the saying that it was Orlando Food Not Bombs, and you're doing it in solidarity with Orlando Food Not Bombs, but then the media would, like, go, oh, my God, there were even people camping out in Santa Cruz and getting busted in solidarity with Orlando Food Not Bombs. And if we can get a bunch of cities to be doing that, that's going to be really amazing. And right now we have a lot of media attention, like, all the time. So that's something really important. And spread the word every city hall, you know, San Francisco City Hall, anywhere where you can organize this kind of stuff. It would be so powerful. This is on... we're doing it. We got the idea from the Strategy 31, which is the Russian for free speech movement that has been going on. And they discontinued their monthly actions now, but I don't know what they're up to. There's some split. But before, a long time, about over a year and a half, they would go out on the 31st of each month and have an action in front of their city halls. And that's the First Amendment of the Constitution of Russia is Article 31. That's why they do it. So we're doing it on the first of each month in solidarity with the right to the First Amendment, right to assembly and free speech and free expression. And so that's why we're choosing the first.
We're talking with Keith McHenry.
We want everybody to come out.
Talking with Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs. You are tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. I'm extending this a little bit, Keith. I don't know if you got any time now.
I could talk a little more.
I want to know if anybody has any, if anybody would like to call in. We do have a call-in line, 469-3119, area code 831, in case people in other areas are listening. Area code 831-469-3119. 831-469-3119. Hopefully, I can put any questions on the air for you. You can also email me at rnorse3@hotmail.com, rnorse3@hotmail.com, and I'm checking my email right now to see if anybody has actually got anything that they want to ask you, Keith, and I don't see anything coming up at the moment, not on this particular topic. I know that Sacramento Homeless recently won significant parts of a lawsuit in which they sued the city of Sacramento for seizing homeless property and destroying it in Santa Cruz. I've gotten recent reports of homeless property being destroyed, and apparently the policy is unabashed and unapologetic. We find property in homeless campsites, we'll trash it. I mean, sometimes they go through and leave notes that say, we'll be back in a day. That's Take Back Santa Cruz says they will do that. And then sometimes Parks and Rec goes through and leaves notes, we'll be back in 3 days. But the fact is that in Fresno, California, and in Sacramento, courts have found that this is an illegal, not to say unconstitutional practice, which essentially is a form of, you know, theft and vandalism, and resulted in a $2.3 million settlement for homeless people in the Kincaid case in Fresno.
That's great.
In Florida, Food Not Bombs hasn't really successfully won lawsuits for damages anywhere in the country, has it?
Oh, for Food Not Bombs and damages, the only damages that we ever got was, there's some funny ones. There was $29,000 that was awarded, I think Carol Sobel was given that in National Lawyers Guild down in L.A. for some false arrest in Pershing Square of Food Not Bombs. And then there's been, I know Josh Connell received $100,000 from the FBI for false arrest, and he got $20,000 from Orange County for the false arrest of being accused of being a domestic terrorist. And they used the, they claimed his affiliation with Food Not Bombs was evidence of this. So he, but, you know, he had not done anything. So I think you got that. You know, he got, but I don't know a lot. There was also like a few $1,000s, I guess, given to Middletown, Connecticut, Food Not Bombs. And they gave it to St. Vincent de Paul's. So you have things like that, like a little bit, but not in any kind of profound manner.
Do you have a lot of seizure of homeless property going on in Florida, as far as you know, or is?
That definitely is happening. I don't know if there's been any litigation around that issue, but that, yeah, there's like essentially homeless people have no civil rights. I mean, they barely anybody has civil rights in Florida. It's like, it's very crazy. I mean, they have Jeb Bush running this place. And then they've got this other guy, like, you know, running it that's like completely gone out of his mind. And so, you know, and the legislature is as conservative as humanly possible. They reduced unemployment, the amount of weeks and the amount per check in the last legislature and things like that. It's like they're way more ahead in the taking everything off the cliff type legislation than even Wisconsin. You know, Wisconsin's trying to catch up on all these crazy anti-worker laws and stuff like that. It's amazing. Quite crazy. So, and then, you know, people can get up to, I've heard homeless people have been telling me that it's a little bit dangerous. They have to move around the state a bit because per county, there's counties where you get caught not being able to prove that you have a place, a shelter, that, you know, you can get like 6 months in jail, things like that.
Wow. Well, Keith, I guess the next thing coming up is in Orlando, as far as this particular campaign, is a Food Not Bombs serving on Monday?
Yeah, we're going to do the Monday breakfast, and we already have a lot of people. There's some activists coming over from Gainesville. We've had activists come from Melbourne and Space Coast and all that. So they're going to come and risk arrest. We're trying to raise bail money as much as we can. We've got a couple of small donations, but we need donations because one of our problems is it's $100 to get out, and we've got a whole system set up. But, you know, if people can't get out, they could be 30 days in there just waiting for trial. And then if a judge doesn't let them out when the trial starts, there could be another while. We've heard people can do as much as half a year in jail waiting to complete their litigation in these cases. So we're trying to bail people out. And there's also the foodnotbombs.net website. It's got all kinds of resources. So we need people to sign the petition. We're trying to get people to write the United Nations and Amnesty International and the Justice Department. We want people to write the politicians in Orlando. That's all on the web, really easily to find. And we've got the first of the month action. We have a day without food on the 29th. And we're working on local effort to put on the ballot a referendum to overturn the law. And there's many, many different avenues that are happening. And it'd just be great if you can connect with us and also tell others that, we're trying to get the Food Not Bombs movement as strong as possible. You know, not only this campaign with what's happening here, but because of it bringing attention to what's happening, to start new chapters and to get the chapters that do exist to be more active. So.
Well, if we can only get the Santa Cruz chapter to reveal itself, well, I'll be so happy. But I'll let you know how that goes.
Yeah, cool. Well, I'll contact them again, too. Yeah, it would be great if they could call in and talk on the station about their activities. And Santa Cruz is a perfect place for, like, you know, having a vigil in front of City Hall on the 1st of July. So,
Thanks, Keith. I'll bring it up at the next HUF meeting, which is Wednesday at 10 o'clock at the Sub Rosa Cafe, if anybody wants to show up and
cool.
be a part of that.
Yeah, and people also can call me, and I have a toll-free number, 1-800-884-1136. But tons of stuff is on foodnotbombs.net, and really, you know, that's where you can donate. That's where you can find out, like, what's happening with, over here in Orlando with DRest, and it's how to find out how to start your own Food Not Bombs chapter or get involved in Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs.
Hey, thank you, and talk to you again.
Have fun, yeah. We'll keep you posted. You know, I can, you know, if some major development happens here on the Monday arrest, we'll get back to you about that. It's likely that the Wednesday action is going to be huge. We're building so much momentum. It's just incredible. So it's pretty amazing.
Hey, I'll keep it coming.
Thanks so much. Take care, man. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Keith. And that was Keith McHenry in Orlando, Florida. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.1 FM, freakradio.org in Santa Cruz. Call in if you'd like. Call in number is 427-3772 and 469-3119. Selection from a group I've found on the streets, a pre-release from the Bellboys. The name of the album was I'll Be Here All Night, and the name of that selection was Something in My Mind. And actually, here's the title song to that particular, from that particular CD. They sounded pretty darn good. They were playing in front of New Leaf, and so I thought I'd give them a try. And, well, I did. I think what I'm going to do now, though, is move on to a few street interviews. We've gone far afield at there in Orlando. It ain't really that far afield. It's the same struggle for social justice and against bureaucratic craziness and the twisted priorities of our current society. But it is in Orlando, and we're in Santa Cruz. It's 3,000 miles away. But we faced the same struggle here. And may again, I've talked about this when I put out an email about the show. I was pointing out that even recently, Father Joel Miller of the Calvary Episcopal's meal is under attack from former Mayor Cynthia Matthews, is also now delving into ways to slash social services, which she's doing behind closed doors, a specially appointed committee by the Coonerty gang at the City Hall. At least according to today's story in the Santa Cruz Sentinel. And we've had other people driven indoors and away from the downtown, like Pastor Dennis Adams from the town clock. Santa Cruz doesn't push too hard on that issue because it got burned, I think, and also because, I don't know, maybe the right wing, as I call it, is mobilizing its forces. I mean, you have had the increase and expansion of anti-homeless laws in Santa Cruz significantly in the last few years. You've had this bizarre and a completely unconstitutional crackdown on Peace Camp 2010 involving suddenly making it a misdemeanor to hold up a sign at City Hall at night. I don't think that's true of any other City Hall in the... I don't know where it's true elsewhere in the state or in the country. If that's true, Santa Cruz did that, and not through a city council action, but through an administrative edict by Danette Shoemaker in collusion with Martin Bernal, the city manager, True Power in the city, Mayor Mike Rodkin, and Police Chief Kevin Vogel, and that was last fall. That's never been challenged, and it's going to have significant effects. I mean, if Huff or another group does decide to do an action in solidarity with Orlando Food Now Bombs, serving people on the 30th of June and staying overnight at City Hall and going into the early morning hours and then serving breakfast, assuming we're still there, it's going to be, they're going to face citations and possible arrests for being at City Hall at night. And that we'll have to see what comes of that, whether we're going to do it, whether, how it's going to be done, if there's enough interest in doing it. But Huff does meet every week, Wednesday, at the Sub Rosa Cafe at 703 Pacific. And I invite people to come on down on Wednesday and talk about maybe doing this. There has been some talk about establishing a Peace Camp 2011, and this could be a place to begin. Who knows? So, let's move into a few street interviews, because that's what I've been doing at least part of the time. And... hey, I do it so folks can be heard who are talking on the streets so that their voices can get out to you. I encourage you who are listening, if you've had similar experiences or have some reactions, questions, comments, definitely to call in at 831-427-3772, 427-3772. We're also waiting for a call from Mike Rhodes, and we kind of extended Keith McHenry's time. That may have bumped Mike, who's a Community Alliance writer in Fresno and an activist who had a report on the crackdown on one of the homeless encampments going on in Fresno, as well as some police abuse going on in that city. But we'll have to see if he actually calls in tonight. And that's a possibility, too. And so are the possibility that you might call in. So think about that. 427-3772.
Pacific Avenue. at about 4:30 in front of the New Leaf Theater. As I said, we're having quite a crowd around the force. Four drummers and one man on drums and one little girl dancing. It's Howdy the Bell Boys CDs, $10. It might be reasonable. I'm going to check it out. Talking with
Catherine Mathian.
Catherine, you are a bell girl.
I'm a bell girl, yes.
Do you also play, or are you just a manager?
I just help them out when I can.
You just run things.
Yep. They listen to me for some reason.
And where are you all from?
We're from Portland, Oregon.
And are you doing this in every city, passing, stopping on the streets?
We're here, and then tomorrow we'll be in Santa Barbara, and then they have a show on the 11th in L.A.
And you just came from San Francisco?
Yep.
And what's your average take on an afternoon like this?
How much do they make? On a good day, about $300 or $400, hopefully.
How many hours to do that?
6 or 7.
And any problems with police or authorities in any particular town?
Usually they're pretty nice, and just remind us of the rules. And
whoa!
We don't really have a lot of problems other than that.
When are you going to pick up an instrument and join the gang? You're pausing on that one.
Yeah, don't hold your breath.
Alrighty. We've been talking with
Catherine Battalion.
Thanks, Catherine. And how can people catch music online from this group?
They can get on the website, bellboysband.com,
uh-huh.
And also on Facebook, The Bellboys PDX.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So I'm here in front of Joe's Pizza, where we're across the street from the grooving band that's thumping away there, and I'm talking with
Casey Livingood.
Casey, you're out on the sidewalk. You're kind of an employee serving soup from a threefold container, kettle, traveling hot plate. How's tricks?
How's what?
Are you getting much in the way of soup samplers?
Yeah, I guess so.
Do most of the samplers go inside after our sampling, or pass on with a sneer?
Some go inside, some just walk on, some, yeah. Sure.
A little of this, a little of that, and
yeah, a little bit of everything.
It is a Sunday, and of course, I guess it's a tourist summer coming up, but you say that you observed a new kind of cooperation between the so-called hospitality yellow jackets and the first alarm security?
Yeah, they were just walking side by side for about a half hour or an hour, as far as I could see, and I watched them walk across the street and talk to about three or four
criminal leaners,
of course, you know, homeless individuals, and I'm not sure what they said, but they picked up their bags and just stood there.
So in other words, they had been seated or leaning and they took a more upright position?
Of course. And yeah, so there you go. They're just standing. I guess they were told they can't lean their stuff up against the building, so.
I'm not sure that that's actually a crime.
Or lean themselves up against
more of a
it.
Fashion. How is the soup, folks?
Good. I actually got a ticket for sitting against a building.
How long ago?
Just a couple days.
Well, I know you can get a ticket for sitting, but you can't get a ticket for leaning.
Really?
No, it's not legal. It is illegal to sit down on the ground,
yeah.
Because we know that hurts the sidewalk if you do that. There's to cause cracks, eruptions, fungus, that sort of thing.
I guess.
Where has your butt been? Well, consider that.
My butt has been
with you all the time.
It's been with me, yes.
I mean, you know, we don't want the riffraff like yourself cluttering up the streets, you understand?
I understand.
And what is your name?
Mallory.
And you are with?
Vinny.
And did you also get a citation for sitting on the sidewalk?
I've got plenty of other unreasonable citations from Officer Winston and Officer
Clark.
Yes, they suck. They should be fired.
Now, when was the last...
Put me on that one if you hear this, buddy. I hate you.
Now, when was the last time you got a citation?
I got a loitering ticket. for walking through a parking garage about 2 hours later because they didn't like where I was. I don't think you can get a loitering ticket 2 hours later just because the cop feels like giving it to you after they already had to talk to you. I don't think that's legal.
And which garage was it?
The one down there at the opposite, the end of Pacific, close to the River Street.
And were you standing, sitting, leaning, talking, chatting?
I walked through the parking garage. They said, don't be in the parking garage or you can get a loitering ticket. Then I was all the way at CVS, and they saw me, and they were like, I think I'm going to give you a loitering ticket for being in that parking garage 2 hours ago.
Well, but you gave them an opportunity to reflect, to think about the situation. You, in essence, assisted them in doing their job.
Yes.
You feel proud about that?
I'm so very proud. I hope they get that big fat check at the end of the week.
And, in fact, it is not a crime to walk through a parking lot or garage, although in Santa Cruz, it is a crime to sit in your car in a parking lot or garage. It is a crime to chat with friends in a parking lot or garage. It is a crime to, I don't know, work on a vehicle in a parking lot or garage. It's a crime to wait for your children to come out of the movie in a parking lot or garage. It's a crime to discuss the Constitution, let's say, inside a vehicle in a parking lot or garage. All those are crimes. And nor, I'm not saying that any of them have been the subject of an arrest, but the actual wording of the Coonerty parking lot panic law, as I call it, or the parking lots and garages trespass law, as they call it at city council, states you can only walk directly through a parking lot or garage and only go in to get your vehicle or retrieve it, during which time you have 15 minutes to get or retrieve your vehicle, to park or retrieve your vehicle. So, but here we have an example, apparently, if Vinny, as he describes himself, is accurate, of a situation where he was walking through and then was warned that that would be a criminal offense if he loitered or hung out or whatever, which technically it would be under Santa Cruz's constitution-free Coonerty law. Coonerty is, of course, the mayor of our city and the author of this law. But then later he got a citation for what he did 2 hours before, which was apparently not illegal, walking through, if his account is accurate. So, who knows? I wasn't there.
How long ago was this act of charity on your part?
About a month and a half ago.
And what about you? How long ago did you get a ticket?
Just a couple of weeks.
And this was a sit-on-the-sidewalk ticket?
Yeah, I was just kicking it with some homies sitting on the sidewalk.
And who gave you the ticket?
Winston.
He's Officer Winston, again, I think he's pushing to, you know, really get a better grip on the situation.
He's just angry because his wife bangs other girls.
Now, do you know this because you know his wife, or is this simply a rude comment on your part?
I banged his wife.
Officer Winston, take note. So
there he is.
Motherfucker, we're walking. Anyway, we got to be somewhere.
Have you been talking with
Mallory
and
Devin?
Is this okay to put this on the radio?
Yeah.
Yes, please put
this
it on the
radio.
Oh yeah. All right, but do we get an interview with anybody's wife? Is the question.
I do.
I have no idea.
You want the full story next time we talk to you?
For sure. I'll be talking to you later then.
Hey, thank you.
Take care.
All right. Okay, again, it's.
And, of course, it's, you know, people's sexual activity is really no business of anybody. And I'd like to state for the record here, though, this was played on the air. I couldn't care less who's, you know, involved with anybody else. But what I am concerned about is the impact of these officers in illegal and unconstitutional behavior on the Santa Cruz streets. We do have a caller here. Let's see. Hi there. You're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert, it's Mike Rose in Fresno.
Hey, Mike, I'm glad you called in. For some reason, I got the mistaken idea you were calling at 7, not 7:30.
Oh, I don't know how that could have happened.
No,
that's what I said I was going to do.
Well, that's I'm here you are, and welcome to Free Radio.
Well, thanks for having me. Did you give your listeners an overview of what was happening here?
I actually mentioned that I was waiting for a call from you because you are an activist in Fresno, a perennial writer. I looked at this huge number of stories that the Community Alliance newspaper and I guess the indiebay.org/Central Valley website has printed on homeless activity, a repression of homeless people, legal response against that repression in Fresno, and that's we're talking dozens of stories, and I think probably most of them were written by you, right?
Yeah, probably over 100. And, yeah, I mean, it's at this point, it's book length.
You just can't stop, can you?
Well, or they can't stop. They continue just one action after another, and it seems to have escalated in the last couple of days. I mean, there was a cleanup that took, I use that in quote, cleanup, down at one of the encampments today where they cleared out about 20 tents. And the folks then moved down to another part of the street. So they really didn't, like, accomplish anything. The city, that is, didn't really accomplish anything by chasing homeless people off of one part of the street because they just moved down to another part.
What was the point? Why did they do that?
They claim they have a construction project they're going to begin at the place where they were located. And that's one of the tactics they use here. They say, oh, well, we need to do something here, so people are going to have to move on. And the last time they did it was they were going to put a water tower up. This was about 2 years ago, and they never did it. This time they say that they're going to do some work on a pump that is at a water station nearby, and they need access to that that space. So who knows? Maybe they will come in and work on that pump, or maybe they won't. But the problem is that they forced homeless people to move from one place to another without having any safe and legal place to go. I mean, even when they're on public land, it's like, they're not part of the public or something, and they have to move on.
You know, the same kind of pretexts were used in Santa Cruz. I'm thinking back some time. I'm often accused of being too historical and thinking back too far, and I probably do. But 16 years ago, when the Mike Rotkin, who was then mayor, and council member Scott Kennedy, who was vice mayor, destroyed through threat the homeless encampment that was called the Back 40, or that's what was generally known as. This was a camp that had like 200 people living in it in around December of 1995. They claimed that the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, which is the group of poverty pimps who were kind of supposedly running the camp and had agreed not to force people to move for several weeks at least where they could kind of get their bearing, suddenly declared they were putting up a thing called Community House, and they did nothing of the kind. For a year and a half, they took no action at all. So it's apparently a tactic that, you know, isn't unique to Fresno.
Right, right. And the other thing that happened this week is that there's a very large camp. There's probably 100, 150 people at this camp that is on Santa Fe, next to a railroad, and Ventura in downtown Fresno. And most of the people that are living there are what's referred to as 290s, or they've sexual offenders, and they are on parole. And their parole, the story that I've heard from several people there, is that the parole agent, when they get out of prison, they have a little money that they give them. Their parole agent takes them over to Big Five or some other sporting goods store, tells them to buy a tent and a sleeping bag, then takes them to the encampment at Santa Fe and Ventura, tells them that they're going to live there and that, they have to, they have a curfew at 7 o'clock, so they have to be there at least by 7, and otherwise they're followed by a GPS ankle bracelet wherever they go. So
are there toilet facilities at this camp?
No, there's not. That's a big problem. The city provides no public services at all, so they've got to stay there, but you could see the problem right away. The parole had a mandatory meeting yesterday with all the 290s that are at this camp and told them that they were going to have to move someplace to be compliant with the restrictions under Megan's Law, which restricts them to, they can't live within 2,000 feet of a school, a daycare center, or a park. Well, in Fresno, Fresno, there's no such place. And so the only place they've been allowed to stay is in this godforsaken place by a railroad yard. And that now they're telling them that they're going to have to move, and they're being told that they have to find some place that is compliant. And, of course, the question they had, or the comment they had at this meeting from talking to them, was, well, there's no place to go. There is no place that we can go to. And the response of the parole was, well, that's not our problem. That's not my problem. You've just got to work that out.
Let me understand this. Unless a new park or school or daycare center was suddenly created, these parole officers were illegally and, sounds like, inhumanely taking people to this particular camp, these 290s, as you call them, and, you know, demanding they stay there in violation of Megan's Law. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's probably not far from the truth. And I don't know what was the moving factor in getting this, getting them to have this meeting to force them to move. But they gave them till July to move out. And then the city's going to, they said, the city is then going to come in and bulldoze whatever's left.
How many people are involved?
There's probably 100, 150 people that live there. It's huge. It's a whole, like a whole city block long. And they're just tents and structures, one right after another. It's been there for a couple of years now. And I was visiting some people over there yesterday afternoon, and I was really impressed with the structures that they have. A place guy I was visiting, him and his girlfriend, they've got this place that it's two rooms. He's got a living room. In his living room, he's got a couch. They've got a couch and a coffee table, and then they've got like a bedroom in the next room. And then they've even got a little backyard that they've got fenced off behind them. It's gotten quite established. After people live there for a couple of years, you start, you know, bringing in things like couches and, you know, putting a backyard up, you know, fence around your backyard. And they've got a dog in the backyard. And it's very, you know, very much just like it is a regular home.
Does this have a kind of a middle-class quality to it? I mean, I know most homeless encampments don't, but this is an encampment of so-called sexual offenders. Are we talking about a higher income level of people who are there than, let's say, the other homeless encampments?
No, but one of the interesting things, Robert, you know, I think they have a lot of the same problems as every homeless person does, in terms of just trying to survive. In fact, they probably have a number of additional obstacles, too, because there's a certain stigmatization that takes place when people hear that they're sexual offenders. So people don't want to give them jobs. But their view of it is a little different. It's like they like living there because there's less crime, there's less drug dealing. It's kind of a different environment than you find at some of the other encampments. And I'm not saying that all the other encampments are, you know, crime-infested drug dens, but there are differences, substantial differences among the different homeless encampments, and there's a significant stratification about how homeless people view themselves and where they fall in that order. The people at the tool sheds, for example, and we've talked about this before, the city of Fresno has provided the Poverello House, which is the social service agency, with about 100 tool sheds. And the people that live in these tool sheds think, they believe that they're better than other homeless people because they have a house, sort of, that they go to, and they've got certain facilities that are around them. Like inside that compound, they have some security. They have a portable toilet. They have trash bins. So those people that live there think of themselves as being different from homeless people that are living out on the street. And in fact, they have a rule at the tool shed city that the people from there in the tool sheds cannot talk to the people who live on the outside. And so it's reinforced by the Pavarello House, the staff of the Pavarello House, who has rules about who they can even interact with. And then the 290s, who are like, this is about a mile away where this encampment is, they don't want to go down to the Pavarello House because they find it to be dangerous down there.
And let me ask you about that. I mean, what's the crime rate, as far as you know, based on either anecdotal or harder evidence you have in the 290s camp? And does that camp have a name, by the way? Or
no, not that I'm aware of.
We're talking about all these sexual deviants, these, you know, these sex offenders, and you're talking, I mean, you haven't got any sense of the breakdown, how many are actually violent people. Is there much violence in this, you know, in this homeless encampment of 290s?
Not that I'm aware of. It seems like a pretty placid place, actually. It seems calmer than it does at some of the other encampments.
Have you talked to the police about police calls to that area, or, you know, and I don't mean for parole violations for not registering as a sex offender, but, you know, real crime.
I haven't done a study like that, but, you know, you talk to people that are there, and so, you know, when you say somebody's a sexual offender, and we talked about this a little bit yesterday, and people said, yeah, but you know what, you know, here's what happened to me. And so one person had taken a leak, been driving a car, was between any place he could stop, and he was arrested because he went and took a leak, and now he's a registered sex offender. There are people in that category that are there. Somebody else was, you know, 20 or 21, had a 17-year-old girlfriend. Father didn't like them being together and turned him in, and now he's a sexual offender. So there's a pretty wide range. And then there are people who molest little kids. So you have a pretty wide range of the people that are out there, but they're not all like demented, evil, violent people.
Is there much organization in the camp? I mean, do they have meetings? Do they have elected officials? Is there any kind of, you know, organized discussions as to what to do? And do they help each other if there are problems that arise?
You know, I just talked to a couple of people about that. That wasn't the main topic of conversation. Most people were concerned about where they're going to go next. But the one conversation when that did come up, it was about how the people in the immediate area around them, maybe five or six people that live close by, look out for each other's things and for each other. So it's not a matter of everybody in the camp getting together and having meetings and deciding things. It's not that well structured, but I get the feeling like, you know, proximity has a lot to do with the relationships of the people that are there. And so this couple that I was talking to said, yeah, the people next door here and on the other side, then if they have to go somewhere, we look out for their things and vice versa. So, you know, people are cooperative on that level, but I don't think that there's big group meetings. They don't have a lot of rules. I think, you know, one of the big issues is just people, you know, having these bracelets on and being forced to live there. And now they're being told that if they don't find someplace else to live, that they're going to go back to prison. And that was the solution. They said, either you go to the rescue mission, which is down by the Pavarello House, and stay there, or you're going to be going back to prison if you don't find some place that's compliant with Megan's law.
And I guess we don't have any activist groups interested in the rights of sexual offenders, huh? ACLU has not moved in to make this a big cause or anything.
Well, I don't know that anybody has. We're working on a story about it to bring it to the attention of the community for the Community Alliance newspaper. But, you know, it's not a group that people feel sympathetic towards.
Well, I know there used to be NAMBLA, you know, National Man Boy Love Association, I think it was at one time, claiming rights of men to associate with younger men and children, and that was not a very popular position either. Talking with Mike Rhodes, go ahead. We're talking with Mike Rhodes in Fresno. Let me just do that brief intro. You also, I guess, were concerned about police abuse that's happening there.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Robert, because I've been following this case in Fresno. There was a shooting not last Saturday, but the Saturday before, where there was an officer-involved shooting of a man. His name's Angelo Fernandez. And what happened is that Angelo and his brother and his brother's girlfriend had gone to a store. These unmarked cars pulled up both in front of them and behind them. Armed men jumped out of the cars, and Angelo took off across the field, the parking lot. And he's kind of heading to the other side of the parking lot, which would have been an empty field. And the officers that arrived chased him and then shot him in the back as he ran away. He was unarmed and shot in the back. And we've just learned that the officer that shot him has been involved in numerous other shooting incidents.
Names of the officers?
Yeah, it's Chris McKnight, and he has shot and killed two people previously. I understand he's been involved with four previous officer-involved shootings, so I guess this would be the fifth one. And then they took Angelo to the hospital. Well, first of all, let me go back a little bit. When he was shot, then five or six officers, and I spoke to several witnesses at the scene yesterday, people who worked at the supermarket there, who saw the officers, five or six officers, go over and begin kicking him repeatedly while he was on the ground and had been shot in the back. The police chief, Jerry Dyer, here, held a press conference immediately, well, that day, that afternoon. This happened somewhere around noon. In the afternoon, Dyer held a press conference where he told the media and the public that this person was a wanted gang member, has a violent past, and the officer shot him because he felt that he was going to run into the grocery store and take hostages. The thing that's really troubling about that is, well, one, he wasn't running towards the entrance of the store at all. He was running across a parking lot to a field to escape. And then the other thing that's troubling about that is, how would an officer know what crime might be committed sometime in the future?
Now, wait a minute. This officer could very well be a precognitive officer with a very particular telepathic sense. I don't think you should be derogating the Fresno Police Department's advanced tactics.
Yeah, well, if they want to put that out there, I would like to see the statement. I think they're on pretty shaky legal ground myself. I just don't see how they can get away with shooting somebody who is unarmed in the back and then going on television and talking about the person's violent history, that he's a gang member, that they were expecting him to take hostages, that that he had told people that he wasn't going to be taken alive, that, you know, they paint this picture of a violent criminal, and they share this narrative with the community about why they're justified in shooting an unarmed man in the back.
Now, while I'm sympathetic with, you know, your whole perspective on this, extremely sympathetic, let's take the devil's advocate position here. Have you done any independent research around the issue of Angelo Fernandez, the man who was shot dead, I take it?
No, he actually lived, which is one of the things that's relatively remarkable about this, because usually when the Fresno Police Department shoot somebody, they kill them.
So not only are they telepathic and precognitive, but apparently they're not very good shots.
Well, it was a 40 caliber pistol, which is pretty significant, and did a lot of damage. So what they did with him afterwards is they took him to the hospital, and then a couple days later they put him in the Fresno County Jail in a cell with rival gang members. Nobody's saying that Angelo was not a gang member, but for them to then put him into a cell with a rival gang, he's a Bulldog gang member, from what I understand, and they put him in a cell with skinheads who then beat the shit out of him. I've done a little bit of research to find out about Angelo Fernandez. I was speaking with his brother yesterday for a couple of hours, and I talked to his family members. He doesn't have a violent history, from what I can find out. I think he was in prison on a drug charge and had been released about a month and a half ago. Apparently, he didn't get along with his parole agent. The parole agent contacted his girlfriend's grandmother and told her that she should stay away from him because something's going to come down. And that makes one wonder what she knew about all of this. Did she know that the police were going to have a shootout with him? I mean, Fresno police have had a history of what I would consider extrajudicial executions of people that are gang members, particularly in the Bulldogs. They simply track them down and shoot them. Usually they kill them. That's one of the reasons why this is a little unusual. And then I went down today to try to talk to Angelo. I got on his visitors list at the Fresno County Jail and went there, and presented myself to visit with him, and they said, sorry, he's already had two visitors this week, and that's his limit, so you'll have to come back next week. So they're not being overly generous in allowing visitors into the Fresno County Jail.
Is that the standard practice for people in the jail? You only get two visitors per week?
I'm looking into that. It seems a little...
Because it may be. I mean, you know... Stupid and, well, I mean, you know, abusive as it may be their standard abuse.
Yeah, well, I'm looking into that. I don't know what the answer is yet, but that's what they told me, and it just seems very restrictive to me.
It is very restrictive, and it's bullshit.
Yeah.
We're talking with Mike Rhodes, and it looks like we're reaching the end of the hour. Mike, are you going to write about these stories for people who maybe tuned in late or want to have more information or want to... You know, look it over again, can go to read the situation again, or what's the deal?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm working on the article about Angelo Fernandez right now, and we will have several articles on the situation with the homeless here in Fresno. That'll all be in the July issue of the Community Alliance.
And where can we find, for those who really, I'm like myself, are fanatic historical buffs who want to look at your 100 older articles on the homeless? Because I'm really impressed that somebody's been doing a chronology of articles. I mean, I kind of try to do that for Santa Cruz a little bit, but when somebody does it, I want to give them full credit and also let people know where they can go to get access to it. How you just go online to the Community Alliance newspaper? Or?
Right, yeah. So what you do is go to FresnoAlliance.com, and then on the left-hand side you'll see something you click on. It says homelessness or homeless, and you click on that, and then you'll just scroll down and keep scrolling down, and you'll come to a chronology of the articles on homelessness. It might take you 2 minutes to get to where it's located. We're going to try and put that up on so it's a little easier to find. But right now, that's the way to get to it, and there is a treasure trove of information there.
Yeah, I mean, photos, in some cases video. Thank you very much for doing your usual last-minute patient informative coverage of stuff that you know, most of us would never know about if you didn't talk about it. So
you would not get this news through the mainstream media. I'll guarantee you that.
Well, you know, just watch out for Bob Aronson and his latest cover-up as police auditor. That's all I can tell you. I was reading his, you know, what he did in, what is it, Modesto with his, and everything's okay with the Modesto situation with the police abuse case there that sounded like, I don't know. I know Aronson personally. I'm really sorry to, he's a nice guy, but, you know, he's, it's depressing to hear that's what he's doing. But I remember we talked a couple of years ago about how having a police auditor wasn't worth warm spit, as Vice President Garner put it when he was asked what the vice presidency was worth. Or maybe that was Teddy Roosevelt. I don't know. Anyway, thank you for being on the show, Mike, and we'll talk again.
Thanks, Robert. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Yeah, take care, man. That's it for Bathroom Spares Broadsides on Sunday. I'll be coming back at 9:30 to talk about the Supreme Court, the petition for certiorari, which is the city attorney's $5,000 bondugal to try to get my, well, essentially to get some mayors off out of a trial situation where they will be facing a trial for false arrest when they arrested me 9 years ago for not leaving the city council when they told me to go because I'd raised my arm in a mock Nazi salute after they had threatened arrest of other people in the audience improperly. Anyway, I'll be talking about that. I'll be talking about other things. I'll just talk and talk, and you can talk too. In the meantime, you can maybe listen to a little talk from Uncle Dennis, who's coming in with the cream to the dregs. He's got music. He's got reports. He's got papers he's trying to get together. I don't know what he's going to do, but you'll find out if you hang tough here. Dennis, you got some music you want to put on to cover your paper crackling?
Oh, I suppose. I'm trying to find a blank sheet of paper. He's looking
for a blank sheet of paper. I don't think I have one myself, so I can't really help you. Between times, if you'd like to get in touch with me, the number to call, as ever, is the HUFF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom Line, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And, hey, if I don't answer then, I will try to get back to you if you can leave me either a phone number or an email or some way to get back to you. Thanks for being at the listening end of this particular broadcast, and I'll do it again, if you will.
No.
Oh, yeah.
Again.
Oh, yeah.
There's more?
That's it. I'm turning over the mic now to one of my fans, the well-known Uncle Dennis. He'll give you more details on the kind of praise that probably undeserved that he's going to give me.
And thank you, Robert, for another wonderful show here on Free Radio. And
glad you liked it, Dennis.
Actually, I didn't listen to much of it. But thank you for doing it anyway. It's, you know, our airtime is so valuable that we like to fill it with the finest of programming. And we hope that our listeners feel that this the service we've provided to the city of Santa Cruz and the world, I might add, for the last 16-plus years, has been worth the effort and certainly worth the expense. If you want to hear more of Robert, he will be back on Sunday morning at 9:30, unless he can waggle some more time out of Mr. Thomas Levitt, who's in danger of losing his show.
He is in danger,
yes. Yes, he is. So you better let Thomas know that he's got to pony up or
hit the road, Toad.
Well, no, we'll just lock the door and he won't get in.
Change the combination.
Yeah, it happens. That's because every programmer has to pay dues so that we can pay the rent. But we get help from the community in paying dues. So let's see here. Let's play this one, a little Pink Floyd from The Piper at the Gates of Dawn.